You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a researcher about the state of science literacy in the United States and how we compare to the rest of the world.
First, when fossils of human ancestors are displayed in a museum, they become the center of an exhibit, and you could say that the remains can take on a life of their own. Think of Lucy, a female human ancestor that was found in Ethiopia in the 1970s. None of us knew her, but we all seem invested in knowing more about her. The nearly 3.2 million-year-old skeleton made headlines this week when a new study said it finally figured out how Lucy died. She probably fell from a tree.
Our next guest just released a book that explores the controversies, exhibitions, and stories that make fossils like Lucy into celebrities. Lydia Pine is a writer and historian who focuses on the history of science and material culture. Her book, Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils, is out now. Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we think of fossils probably as, these important scientific specimens. They tell us about the history of the world. You kind of go beyond that into how some fossils become almost pop culture celebrities. Why did you want to tackle that?
I love the idea of exploring why some scientific discoveries become famous and others don't. I felt that it was important to sort of peel back the layers and to say it's not just because of its scientific importance that something becomes celebrity or it becomes famous, but I wanted to see the culture and the history and the media and the everything else that sort of surrounds a celebrity scientific discovery, and I felt that fossils were a great way to do that.
Oh, I wonder if just a good name is one of the common themes that makes it. Because, I mean, Lucy is better than, you know, fossil AX13 or something like that. The Piltdown Man on the opposite side of reality is another catchy name. Is just almost, maybe not even on purpose, but that sort of branding part of what, or The Hobbit, of course, is that what part of what captures our imagination?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. That certainly if a fossil is going to become a celebrity, it has a catchy nickname. It has something that is easy to identify with, that it's a name that you can anthropomorphize or personify, and that with these kind of names, fossils can take on these personas. They can become ambassadors for science.
Now, you looked at seven particular skeletons as examples here, and you write you could have done more or fewer, but seven seemed like a good amount. What's the common thread behind this magnificent seven group of fossils?
I like that title. I almost wish now that we had been able to incorporate the magnificent seven.
It's been used, though, so, yeah.
It has. What I think the common thread, though, between these seven is first of all, the fossil is discovered at a time when certain questions are very prevalent in science, and that the fossil is able to answer certain questions that are sort of at the forefront of scientific inquiry. But it also manages to capture public imagination at the same time that it's discovered. And so it has these sort of dual threads that propel it towards celebrity, both scientific importance, but also it resonates in a cultural way, whether it's Neanderthal at the beginning of the 20th century or The Hobbit at the beginning of the 21st. There are sort of cultural reasons for people to want to be curious about them.
Is it just that they tell a story, you know, with the popularity of TED Talks and other things like that, science, but in a catchy story form? Is that what captures the public imagination?
I think that it definitely captures public imagination with the story form, but I also think that sort of having this character, this familiar sort of fossil, this sort of familiar persona is a way of identifying and making human evolution, which is very abstract, a way of feeling much more personal and much more real. And so I think that these become familiar characters that we can identify with.
We're talking to Lydia Pine. Her new book is called Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils, looking at how some of our early human ancestors became celebrities in a way millions of years after they died. And Lydia, you've seen some of these up close and personal, including one from South Africa. And it was the awe of the situation was a little bit dissipated, I think. Can you talk through that story?
Sure. So when I was an undergraduate, I had the opportunity to attend a paleoanthropology field school that was held in South Africa. And as part of this field school, we went to the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg to see famous fossils and to see these fossils that were very much part of South Africa's history of paleoanthropology. Professor Philip Tobias at that point was sort of South Africa's living legend of a very eminent paleoanthropologist, and was responsible for giving us this fossil demo, for talking us through all of these different meaningful fossils in South Africa's history. And at the point that he was getting ready to show off the Tong child, all of us undergraduates were just so excited to see the real thing. We had all seen casts and replicas, but we hadn't seen the real thing before. And so we were just on the edges of our seats to see it. And so he pulls it out of the box and sort of starts having its little mandible clack against the teeth of it, of its upper teeth, and sort of starts to do this ventriloquy act. And all of us were just shocked. I mean, it was just, this is, you know, it was sort of like putting a mustache on the Mona Lisa or something. It was just this dissonance that we couldn't wrap our heads around of how could somebody so famous treat something like this so famous? How could that happen? And what struck me, though, in doing the research for Seven Skeletons, and what struck me as really interesting, is that just about anybody who had met Professor Tobias when he was alive and had seen him do this demo, they would tell you the same story. And that struck me, that that story, sort of having that ventriloquy act, was just as much a part of this fossil's life as its caliper measurements and its CT scans. But it added this cultural dimension to it.
And with something like the Tong child, I mean, you were saying you approach it almost like, you know, we might approach the Mona Lisa. It's this thing we've heard about, and there's something special about being in its presence, witnessing the real thing. They become scientific, but almost spiritual icons, it seems like.
I think so. I think that there's definitely a sense that these fossils become these cultural touchstones. And it strikes me that we use them sort of as quick shorthand or cultural reference. Anytime a new fossil is published or there's a media blip about a new fossil that's been discovered, it will almost invariably contain a reference to Lucy, for example, that a fossil will be older than Lucy. It'll be younger than Lucy. It walked bipedally, just like Lucy. And so it struck me that these fossils, these celebrity fossils, become ways for us to identify with and to really sort of create a narrative about human evolution.
Is there a lesson here for scientists and science writers to help communicate with the public, but in a good, positive way? You know, when we hear about a new fossil, human origins are really complicated, and you can really dig down into the weeds here, and I think that a lot of it can be eye-glazing. Is there a way to take what you've learned from these celebrity fossils and make scientific communication more successful?
Well, I think that Lucy actually can be a really great example of that, sort of finding something that is familiar, a fossil that's familiar, and sort of being able to use that to talk about, as you point out, human origins that are incredibly complex. Sort of having a fossil that's familiar, that this new discovery, or that this discovery that scientists are looking at in a new way, that there's a way of referring to these celebrities as guiding posts, or as sort of characters that are familiar. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. It sort of keeps you, I think, from having to reinvent the wheel or re-explain things all the time.
Well, one of those stories that's been in the news this week is, again, Lucy, with maybe the mystery of her, I didn't know it was being treated as a mystery, but the mystery of her death maybe being solved. What do you think about this news that, you know, there's been this analysis, it looks like she might have fallen out of the tree, which is starting arguments. Does that mean she and her species lived in trees? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that the paper that's come out actually touches on a very long debate that's sort of been at the heart of Lucy and Lucy's species, of just how much time did Lucy spend in the trees, just how much time did she walk around bipedally, sort of what does all of that mean. I think that the jury is still kind of out with seeing sort of how this discovery resonates. But one of the things that really I found to be interesting was how the paper was reported, how her death was reported. And everything that I would see would say, you know, the world's most famous fossil. And it struck me that because it was Lucy, that there's this interest in the discovery and sort of in her death, that if we were looking at, you know, specimen ABC123, we probably wouldn't have that kind of coverage about. And so it felt like it very much reinforced this idea that people, both inside and outside of the scientific communities, are committed to being interested in Lucy.
Lydia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Lydia Pine. She's a writer and historian who looks at the history of science. Her new book is Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils.
A new national report finds that when it comes to understanding science, Americans perform about as well as other people in developed nations, a result that many find surprising. With so many hot-button scientific topics, energy usage, healthcare, and climate change, how important is scientific literacy or the ability to explain or interpret science to make informed judgments?
Our guest is one of 12 authors of the report. She joins us now to talk about the state of science literacy in the U.S. Dominique Brossard is professor and chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at UW-Madison. Dominique, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with what we thought we knew about science literacy. I think there's a general assumption that we Americans, we don't know as much about science as we should. How did that pan out?
Yeah, and I think that was one of the impetus for the National Institutes of Health to commanditate a report to the National Academy of Science and Engineers to see if this, let's say, assumption was correct and if empirical data would support this assumption. So what we realized looking at the available data comparing knowledge and attitude towards science in a number of countries around the world is that the United States is doing, as well as the other developing countries. Obviously, there's no exact answer, that would be similar within each country because it's difficult to find similar questions. But overall, I would say we fare well.
Was that a surprise, do you think?
I've been working on the issue of scientific literacy and controversial science in general for a very long time, so I wasn't particularly surprised, but I think it was extremely healthy for a federal agency to commandite that report to really, call into question that assumption that a lot of people have. And I think it may be coming as a surprise to a lot of people, not because of the result itself, but because there is still the assumption that the large, widespread attitudes we have in the United States towards some issues such as climate change, GMOs, and et cetera, are due to a lack of knowledge. And as a matter of fact, that's something else that our report looked at, is the relationship between that those level of science literacy and attitudes toward these issues. And I think the very important finding is that very often it's not level of science knowledge that explains how people feel about scientific topics.
Right. It's not how much we know that maybe decides what we think about an issue, as you say, like global warming. Part of what you're saying is it's maybe the values we interpret that knowledge with, as I understand your report.
Yeah, and you're exactly correct. And that's where things are complicated. We really, find that people that are extremely knowledgeable about an issue can become very polarized about that issue, right? And the fact that you know extremely well the science behind won't explain how you're going to act upon that science. And very often, it could be important values that are super close to your own self. It could be religious belief in the context of embryonic stem cells. It could be political attitudes in the context of climate change. It could be deference to science in the context of genetic engineering food. So not all the time the same value comes into play, but certainly we shelter the information around us based on things that are important to us.
So how does that change how we educate around science now that we have some new results about how literate Americans are about it?
Yes. What's important is that realizing that science communication is actually that. It's science communication. It's not about educating people. We're talking about, a large number of Americans that are intelligent, well-versed, but cannot, keep up with everything in a way that we suppose they are. They apply your recent mentor talk cuts to make sense of the issues around us. And that means that we need to know those shortcuts. We need to design our communication exchanges, again, conversations, not one-way stream, in a way that takes into account this kind of thing. We have a lot of work to do. Look, yesterday, or like very recently, Bill Nye, the science guy, just announced that he would have a new show on Netflix. Is that going to be called Bill Nye Saves the World? And the way they announced the show, he's saying that he will actually, you know, address the myth that people have about science and correct the misinformation. Well, he may make things even worse, because that's not what it is. What it is about listening to what people have to say and then finding a common ground to make sense of these issues in a way that, you know, that acknowledge and respects others' point of view. So educating and saving the world by correcting misinformation is actually a disastrous way to go about it. So I hope that the report will, you know, reach a large constituency of people that are interested in communicating about science, and they will actually make an effort to understand the psychology behind it, basically.
Talking to Dominique Brossard, she's with the UW-Madison. She was involved in a national report on scientific literacy in the United States. We do pretty well at an individual level, but maybe that's not the whole story she's finding. And Dominique, as you say, it isn't just what individuals know. In this report, you say there's community scientific literacy, sort of a social combined composite scientific literacy that's important, too. How so?
Yeah, and that was, I think, an important component of our report. We looked at science literacy, and we looked also at health literacy. And traditionally in the United States, at least, let's say in the last decade or so, there's been that realization that health literacy is not only something that an individual has, and that the community in which the individual lives, like the structure that's there, the healthcare system, the policy, the hospitals, etc., all these have to be taken into account. Until now, science literacy has been thought as only something that individuals hold. And there is actually now the realization that we need to think about the structure around it, the school, the policies and such, the university, the community, etc. And that a community in itself can develop a science literacy that transcends just the individuals that live there, because they are able to leverage each other's knowledge, each other's interests, each other's strength. And look, and I think our community here in Madison is a good example of it. We have the university with, you know, very knowledgeable scientists. You can have community members that can leverage that knowledge to be involved in local issues in a way that's actually, you know, beneficial for the community. So the structure around, you know, that leverage goes beyond just the individual and brings together a community itself.
Now, we hear a lot about, for instance, education gaps in this country and in Wisconsin in particular, you know, maybe between urban and rural populations, between African American and white populations. Are there populations when it comes to scientific literacy that we need to focus extra attention on?
And this, I'm so glad you point that, Veronica, because this is something that our report also stresses, that you cannot disconnect scientific literacy from what we call fundamental literacy. So at the end of the day, if you have, you know, issues with writing and reading and so on, obviously this is going to impact your capacity of reading about science topics and so on, or even being involved in the community in a meaningful way. So going back to that structural notion I was telling you and the community level and so on, it's important to realize that indeed you have some demographics that will actually end up being on the lower end because of the structural deficiency I was pointing out before.
And Dominique, I wonder if there are lessons here in how we do science education as opposed to maybe, you know, read the textbook, hear the lecture, take the quiz. Does this point toward maybe more a hands-on science education, maybe more here's how this influence or affects this particular issue in our society, bring that into the conversation?
I think, you know, like science has become so, to some extent, expert at what they do, right? We have all those disciplines that have developed and the expert knowledge that develop that we tend to be teaching kids that way, right? Now we're doing, I always give the example, you know, I have a master's in genetics and my kids in ninth grade in high school are taking the classes I was taking at the end of my master's, you know, like 30 years ago. So we're teaching earlier and earlier things that are to some extent more complicated that they need to know as engaged citizens. We should talk about also science in context. with important notion of science literacy, giving up of issues, what are the policies around them, what's the role of the scientists, how do we solve those issues, you know, on a case-by-case, example of communities, examples of the local level where that practical science knowledge takes place. And I agree with you that I think it is time to change the view we think of science education, particularly as issues that depend on science. I'm thinking of gene editing, I'm thinking of climate change, you know, are so relevant to us, and we will have to have an informed citizenry that gets into any policy decision. So we have to rethink, how do we engage people in science in a way that's not a top-down way?
Are there any templates for that kind of education that are in play right now that are doing particularly well, or any particular public figures? You mentioned Bill Nye and the way his new show is being positioned as maybe not being ideal, but anyone who is doing it right?
Well, you know, I think, for example, here at the local level, we are involved with the Mortgage Institute for Research at the UW-Madison in their science festival, and that we have, organized last year a panel that was really a broad discussion with interested citizens about the human genome. And the question was asked, should we edit the human genome? And you had experts that did very brief presentations, and citizens engage in discussions and so on. And our data that we haven't published yet showed that, people learned about it and actually had attitudes that were more sophisticated at the end. And so there are cases like that around the world where people are using, public settings to develop this kind of public engagement exercises that promote scientific literacy in a way that, if you wish, is consistent with what the report is pointing out.
Dominique, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
That was Dominique Brossard, professor and chair of the Department of Life Sciences Communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking with us about the state of science literacy in the United States.
A report released this week tries to put numbers on drug use among Wisconsin youth, particularly among middle and high school students.
The second annual youth survey on risky substance use surveyed almost 2,000 students in 50 school districts and 20 Wisconsin counties to gauge substance abuse and look for solutions. It found that a substantial percentage of students have tried substances that include tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, and harder drugs like heroin and meth, and that more than half of kids who try these substances keep using them.
Anthony Alvarado joins us now. He's co-founder of Rise Together, the nonprofit organization which conducted the survey. Rise Together works to prevent substance abuse among youth through a nationally recognized school speaking program. And Anthony, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on today.
Well, can you lay out some of the key findings of this report on substance use among Wisconsin youth?
Absolutely. So as you indicated, we've been traveling for the last 3 years. We actually have been able to take survey respondents upwards of almost 7,000 students. Last year alone, we were able to take almost 2,000 survey responses in, and we found some alarming results. We did recognize that, yes, about half of the students that were in front of them have already tried some form of drug or actually have experimented with alcohol, while primary usage, starting off with alcohol and tobacco and marijuana, what is really alarming is that we're finding almost 20% of the students have experimented with prescription drugs. And if you know anything about the disease of addiction, unfortunately, that can also lead people to battle substance use disorders, and then maybe even battle long-term addiction. And that, unfortunately, could lead that person into a really tough situation and ultimately death. So in all reality, as serious as this conversation is, while we might be having students say, hey, you know what, I tried drugs and alcohol, and I did it because I was curious or because my friends used, we're also seeing them using drugs and alcohol because a high amount of stress in their life. So they're using it more as a coping mechanism over anything else. And some of those individuals, especially since some students are experiencing trauma or have in the past, or maybe struggling with stress or anxiety or maybe even depression and leading to more mental health concerns such as suicidal tendencies and even contemplating suicide, it really is a combination of combination of struggles that the students are dealing with. And our survey that we have launched to the state is identifying some of those key findings.
And another finding, if I read it right, if a student has tried something once, about half of those students who tried something once are still doing it. Is that right?
Right, that's about right. About one out of every two students that have tried either drugs or alcohol are continuing to use, although we can say that about 80% on average of the students that have seen a Rise Together presentation are indicating that they're less likely to use. So what we do know also that students are really behind learning about the dangers of drugs and alcohol, really interested in further educational and awareness opportunities, and ultimately are recognizing this as a social concern or social crisis. I literally have seen 75,000 plus students take a stand, raise their hand, vocally shout out that drugs are a problem in the community. And that was from all different counties from all over the state. I mean, we're talking 20 different counties last year, but we're talking about 27 the year before. So we're all over Wisconsin. And no matter what community I visit, it's no doubt that drugs are a problem in that community, whether it's a big community or a smaller community. This addiction epidemic that we're in, it does not discriminate. And on top of that, 60,000 plus students have made a stand and said, hey, look, this is also a problem in our school. And while maybe it's more of a problem in high school, it still is the beginning use is starting as early as typically between 13 to 15 years old. So you're talking more within even that middle school environment. So if we're really going to get behind prevention, as if prevention is key, as it is often said, well, then we really need to be educating our students as early as, you know, third grade, fifth grade, all the way through middle school and throughout high school, and develop a fuller curriculum that addresses substance use, addiction, and mental health.
Talking to Anthony Alvarado, co-founder of Rise Together. That nonprofit organization just released some of their new data on drug use among kids, youth, teens in Wisconsin. And let's talk a little more about Rise Together, Anthony, and the approach you take. How is your group in particular trying to turn the tide on drug use among kids?
Well, we primarily focus on an educational school speaking program, which we are considered a national program, but most of our work over the last 3 years has been within the state of Wisconsin. So we take approach with an awesome team of professionals, recovery advocates, even parents that have lost their son or daughter to the disease of addiction, or maybe even treatment professionals and professionals of all sorts, and even musicians. We take the stage, we're able to create a great amount of awareness around these topics within the school environment through our educational presentations. And what that does is create more of an awareness campaign that really helps to eliminate the stigma that surrounds addiction and mental health. So now we are not only engaging those students in the conversation, but we're encouraging them to ask for help for the very first time. And as a resource provider, we can actually connect them with the local resources within the school or outside of the school, and even provide a network of recovery coaches and peer support specialists to potentially work with those families, and also a number of online resources that they can get connected with. What we are recognizing is there's a huge barrier where there isn't as much availability or access to the resources that are available currently in our community. And when students are looking to reach out for help, or even individuals or young people are looking to reach out for help, they don't really know where to turn to. You know, so we're really becoming more of that conduit or the catalyst to that conversation. And, man, it is being a father of two, a 13-year-old and 11-year-old, I couldn't imagine, you know, how difficult it must be, you know, even for my children to feel comfortable enough to ask for help within their school, for example. And they even come home and ask for help. I mean, that's a difficult conversation to have. And what we're finding is that's the same story for thousands and thousands of students. And unfortunately, because of the social stigma that's around these topics, man, these kids are carrying shame and guilt for a long period of time and really lacking, I guess, in the understanding or having the confidence to reach out, regardless of what they struggle with. whether it's substance use or a mental health concern, or even if it's just a specific challenge in their life, I mean, the attitude that we take from stage is really building compassion and empathy and helping to build resiliency in our today's youth for a better future.
You know, Anthony, schools will do screenings for a hearing, eye exams, that sort of thing. Is this a case where, since it's hard for students to take the next step, you're looking for some kind of screening or outreach from the schools, the community, to maybe nudge that kid to take that first step and reach out for help?
Yes, I think even what Rise Together can provide, we do the educational presentation, and school speaking can be impactful, but what's the next step? And we've always looked at that, whether we're in development of a student-led program and helping to extend advocacy and encouraging students to become leaders and take action and fight up against this addiction epidemic that we're in. I think teens have an unbelievable power to do so, and we're going to continue to mobilize them in the best ways possible, because everybody needs to be in this fight kind of conversation. But at the same time, like, what are some evidence-based practices that are out there that can help in this conversation? And that's why we made a policy recommendation around the implementation or tool of ESPERT on a more universal level. So ESPERT, in short, stands for Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment, and it's more of a motivational interview process that takes place with students that may be in risk and maybe aren't in risk, and they can have that forward conversation and address their current use and get them on the path of limiting that use and maybe even to a complete sobriety standpoint, so they don't have to suffer with substance use disorder or potentially a long-term addiction.
Talking about a new report that tries to put some numbers on drug use among middle and high school students in Wisconsin and efforts to help those students stop using those substances. Anthony Alvarado is with us. He's co-founder of Rise Together, a program that helps prevent youth substance abuse.
And we want to hear from you on this. Are you concerned about increased drug use among school kids? Do you know young people who are experimenting or even regularly using drugs? And what do you think we should do to combat this growing problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We're continuing our conversation about drug use among Wisconsin youth, many of them school students. You can join the conversation and tell us what you think. Do you see an increase in young people using drugs in your community? What do you think is the root cause, and what can be done to turn it around? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you could tweet us at Central Time WPR is our Twitter handle.
Anthony Alvarado stays with us. He's co-founder of Rise Together, a program that helps prevent substance abuse among youth. And Anthony, I understand as part of Rise Together, recovering addicts themselves are part of the program, part of the message for kids. Why was that an important part of this?
I think ultimately, even I'll just speak from a personal standpoint, I'm a person in long-term recovery, and what that means is I've been completely clean and sober from all drugs and alcohol for coming up on 4 years this November, and four awesome years at that, and being able to have that lived experience and share that personal testimony and that story of redemption and how we overcame those challenges, whether it was those challenges that we were experiencing back in middle school, maybe in high school, maybe in early parts of our life, we are able to connect and relate to those students on such a level that that's when they start to open up and actually start to listen and want to listen. And so it becomes more of a message of hope, if you would want to say that, because we're not focusing on or glamorizing drug use or focusing on the negatives, but instead the positives of staying clean and sober. And it's actually pretty awesome and pretty cool to be sober. And I don't think if I'm correct, if I know anything at all, that our normal media, movies, music, etc., even spread that message at all. So it is amazing to see not only groups like Rise Together and our team doing the work that we're doing, but millions and millions of people that are in recovery today are starting to unite and share those stories of recovery and tell the world that recovery is possible. And that is also influencing our next generation, which ultimately could help curb this drug epidemic that we're in.
Congratulations on that upcoming 4 years. And let's go to our callers now, Anthony, with Tom in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Anthony makes great points. He's absolutely right. There is a change going on in the culture, and it starts with the young people and the approach to what it means to be in recovery, to be sober. And as a parent of a young man 13 years ago who got into the drug culture in one of our small towns, I decided I needed to take a look at my relationship with substances. And alcohol is the one substance that's the most common, and how the environment that we raise our kids in. And today we run a project called Aaron's House and Grace House, which is recovery houses for college students in Madison. Yeah. And this is our 10th school year for Aaron's House. And these things happen and work because the young people make changes in their lives, but also there's changes that get made in families' lives, too.
Absolutely.
Tom,
absolutely. I love what you guys are doing, especially within the collegiate atmosphere, you know, talking about supporting young people and families all throughout the community. Definitely well aware of what you guys do, and I really appreciate you calling in and just even supporting our message, and we'd like to show that respect and support back to you as well.
Tom, thanks for that call. You know, Anthony, when I think of movie scenes I've seen of recovery and drug treatment, things like that in pop culture, it's this sort of tough love, almost a punitive approach. It sounds like, from what I'm hearing from you and from Tom, our caller, is a more positive approach, as in the positive side of abstaining from substance use.
Absolutely. You got to meet people where they're at. And each person has their own individual story. Each person has their own individual struggles. But ultimately, if we're going to face this addiction epidemic today, we really have to look at it from a public health standpoint and really treat these people as sick people versus bad people. So it's not a punitive program. We're relying on incarceration to arrest addiction and potentially solve it. Not that consequences and the police departments and the police force don't have a part in this, because they absolutely do. But so does all other parts of the community, and that includes the schools, that includes the teens and the youth, that includes the families and young people in recovery and those that have been impacted by addiction. The recovery movement by no means is just for people in recovery. It is for everybody, and it's time that we all start paying attention to this issue, because I could get on my pedestal here, and I do this quite often, and especially during National Recovery Month here in September, we're going to be doing a lot of rallies. The state rally in Madison's coming up, and we speak about these things in such a way where, man, if there was anything else out there that was literally killing our next generation, killing thousands of people every month at this epidemic level or rate, we would be rioting in the streets. We would be nonstop having these conversations at whatever extent we needed, and it would influence pop culture and everything else that we are involved in. But we're just kind of getting there, right? Like, we're just starting to see a tipping point. And I truly believe, to the last caller's point, is it's because of the voices of young people, of our teens, and even the mothers that have lost children due to overdose.
Very briefly, Anthony, because we're just about out of time, as we watch for opioid addiction in Wisconsin, meth addiction, can you give a message for parents, maybe of children entering this age group, a quick note to them to help them avoid these problems?
I think one of the keys, and this is something me and my son talk about, is creating open space, an open environment where your student, your young one, your son, your daughter can actually come to you with the struggles that are going on in their life. Whether it's with substance use or not, creating that safe place of conversation, a consistent one at that, is absolutely crucial, because this isn't just a one-and-done deal. This isn't like we just present this idea or we just talk once at home and then I'm over it. Whether it's sex education, drug education, or just a healthy way of living conversation, make it be as consistent as possible. Also, the prescription drugs, make sure you are taking those prescriptions back if you're not using them longer. Don't leave them out in the open. Leave them locked up. It is extremely crucial that we do that. Far too often, we're discovering that most of the time when teens or youth are getting these prescription drugs, it's within their own homes.
That's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Anthony Alvarado, co-founder of the nonprofit Rise Together. We've been talking about substance abuse by youth in Wisconsin.